In a series in the New York Times called Paying Till It Hurts, Elizabeth Rosenthal has been investigating what determines health care costs in this country. Her most recent article takes a look at how some specialists, particularly dermatologists, have been able to increase their incomes over the last two decades and how that cost is passed along to patients who have little choice but to pay. Patients' costs skyrocket, specialists' incomes soar, appeared in the January 18th edition of the paper. I'm very pleased that it has brought Elizabeth Rosenthal back to our show. It's always a pleasure to see you, even though you always bring bad news. How much of our total health care costs in the United States are payments to doctors?
It's about 20%. So it's not the single biggest cost. That's hospitals. But it's a significant chunk, and we're not using that chunk very well.
And hospital cost was the focus of a previous article in your series. So it's hospital costs, doctors, and then what?
Well, then there are administrative costs, which are huge. Those are the big ones. And then there's a bunch of prescription drug costs. It's you know, when people say, why is our medicine so expensive, I kind of say it's everything.
And you say that minor procedures offer doctors the best return on investment more than major surgeries?
Yes, you know, and that's kind of surprising because, you know, I don't begrudge a neurosurgeon my daughter had a benign brain tumor. You could have paid that man anything on earth. I would have been happy. He trained forever.
And he saved her life.
But these little dermatologic procedures or little procedures in any specialty, they're billed as surgery. So, you know, maybe they're billed at $1,000, $2,000, $500, but this can be as little as freezing off a wart, you know, which you could do with a over-the-counter non-prescription medication, too.
And so a major surgery takes a long time, but a doctor can do 3, 4, 5. How many in a day?
Well, you know, something like bypass surgery, maybe one or two.
No, I mean the minor surgeries.
Oh, the minor surgeries, you know, depending on how you want to classify them, you could do 30 in a day. It's burning off. Imagine just putting a squirt of liquid nitrogen on a wart. That's, you know, $500. Add that up. You can make a lot of money if you can find a lot of warts.
Does a doctor always have to perform these procedures? Can a physician's assistant do it and still bill the patient at the same level?
Yes. Well, it's gotten popular in many types of specialty is something called a physician extender, which can either be a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. So as long as the doctor is supervising, and that may not even be in the same room or in the same office, it's billed as if the physician did it.
Now, I'm assuming that doctors are ethical, but can this create an incentive for doctors to order unnecessary tests and procedures?
Sure. I mean, that's the kind of the problem. Doctors, as in any profession, doctors range from the extremely ethical, who care a lot about their patients, which I say most are, to those who really exploit the billing system we have.
Is it why many doctors in this country act more like entrepreneurs at times than we commonly suppose?
Well, I think we're in this weird chicken and egg or cat and mouse game now with physicians. You know, Medicare and insurers' response is to say, oh, you're not worth that much, so we're going to half the price we pay you for your office visit. And the doctor's response, who's used to getting that income, is to say, well, how else can I make it back? So maybe they'll invest in an MRI machine, or they'll decide that you really need 5 more procedures. So, but the point is, I think that in either case, it's not good for the patients.
Can doctors make more if they own the equipment that they use?
Oh, sure. There are a lot of different ways that doctors make money in some fields.
Well, an MRI machine must be a major investment.
Well, there's a major investment, but then you make your money back by ordering a lot of scans. And if you're in one of those specialties that gets to order scans, you order scans at the MRI you own, and you make back your money pretty quickly. Now, you know, the different kinds of doctors jockey for that business. So those scanners used to be owned by radiologists. Now more and more orthopedists are owning them. So that hurts the radiologist business. But again, these are all business decisions, not medical care decisions.
So then the radiologists have to raise their prices to make up the difference?
Or find new scans or go on salary at a hospital. I mean, there's a lot of shaking out that's going on now. Some of which is good, but the problem is the people who respond entrepreneurially, the doctors who respond entrepreneurially are the ones who are making money. And the doctors who say, you know what, I don't feel good about doing stress tests on 40-year-olds. They don't need it, are the ones who suffer, really.
When you went to medical school, were these things ever discussed?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know,
are there ethics courses?
Well, sure, there are ethics courses, but most of them have to do with patient ethics, how to treat a patient. More and more I'm hearing as a result of this series from medical schools who want me to talk to students about not just the ethics, but the whole payment system.
Well, you're also hearing from doctors who are outraged at you, what you've been writing. Although you write about several different specialties, you focus on dermatology in this article. Is that because it's become especially profitable in the last 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, bad luck for the dermatologists that I chose them, and it's not unique to them what's going on. On the other hand, when you look at the charts of how physician incomes have changed, dermatologists have gone pretty much on par with they were pretty much on par with primary care people 25 years ago, and now they're on par with the surgeons. They have been very clever and effective at monetizing what they do.
My guest is Elizabeth Rosenthal. Her latest article in her series, Paying Till It Hurts, was called Patients' Costs Skyrocket, Specialists' Incomes Soar. It appeared in the January 18th edition of the New York Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The area that caused the most controversy was your discussion of a procedure called Mohs surgery, right. M-O-H-S, named after a man named Mohs?
Yeah, named after a man named Mohs who discovered this procedure in 1937, so not a brand new procedure.
Why has it become so popular in recent decades?
Well, that's kind of why it's in Medicare's crosshairs and why we looked at it. The use of Mohs has increased 400% in the U.S., not in most of the world, but in the U.S. So you've got to wonder, is that because it's such a great tool? It's not like it was newly discovered. And the assumption in Medicare and with insurers, and I think with some justification, is if something takes off that way, you got to look at the money.
Is it more expensive than other treatments?
It's more expensive. And I should say for certain kinds of skin cancers, it is really, really the way to go because if it basically takes off the cancer layer by layer. So you look at it as you're going and you can, in theory, minimize the amount of tissue that's taken off. So for like on an eyelid or on the tip of your nose, I would want Mohs. But what they found is it's being used on backs, you know, on the sides of face, on foreheads, places where much cheaper and easier things would suffice. So why is it being used? Because it's probably profit motive.
If a doctor sees a mole or a spot, Mohs is one of the options?
It's one of the options, and that's part of the problem and why I hope patients will be educated by this story as well. There are many options. There are creams that can treat it. There's a scraping off. There are lots of different ways.
Even if they're cancerous?
Yeah, even if they're cancers. There are lots of different ways to treat these skin cancers. These are not melanomas, which are very dangerous, serious cancers. These are basal cell carcinomas largely that, you know, you can hear of a story, you know, the one in a, you know, million story of one that turned bad if it was neglected for a long time. But generally, they do not metastasize. They won't cause you harm. They can be disfiguring, so they need to be treated. But there are lots of ways to skin this cat, and we choose, as we do in American medicine, the most expensive one.
Well, a lot of doctors who perform Mohs surgery or teach Mohs surgeries wrote angry letters to the Times in response to the article. I'm not sure they saw anybody saying, I agree with Elizabeth Rosenthal on this. What was their argument against what you'd written?
Well, I should say we got a lot of positive letters from dermatologists, including, P.S., dermatologists who forwarded us the talking points that they had received from the College of Dermatology saying, this is what you should say and this is how you should defend Mohs surgery. So we did get a number of letters from dermatologists saying, oh, my God, yes, this is overused. And it bothers me because it gives my profession a bad name. So I think, you know, the defense is that there's an epidemic of skin cancer. You know, we're detecting more skin cancers. We're treating more cancers. And to a point, that's good. right? That's really a good thing. On the other hand, if you're treating, I got a note from a dermatologist who does mostly a very elderly population. If you are treating 90-year-olds with Mohs surgery, you know, they are not going to die of basal cell carcinoma. And P.S., it can hurt them because their skin doesn't heal very well. It leads to infections. So if this technique is used indiscriminately, which I think there's a lot of evidence that it is, including the dermatology societies agree that it's overused, it ends up being hugely expensive and not good for patients.
Aren't an awful lot of medical procedures performed on the elderly that probably shouldn't be, like colonoscopies?
Yeah, this has come up before in the series that we have these general guidelines, and you know, they're applied rather indiscriminately. And you know, because Medicare, like all other insurers, pays a lot for procedures, or relatively well for procedures, and in particular because you can charge facility fees and anesthesia fees, we tend to do. You know, you get paid for doing in American medicine, not for saying, you know what, this is not going to kill you and it could be painful. Let's just leave it alone.
You write about what happened to a woman named Kim Little, not to be confused with Lil' Kim, when a small white spot on her cheek was found to be cancerous. How did its removal end up creating medical bills of over $25,000?
Well, she was pretty shocked by that, which is why she contacted us at an earlier point in the series. You know, basically, it was a little white spot. As many of us have done, she's heard over and over again, you should get skin checks. She's a fair redhead. She went to the dermatologist to look at some moles on her arm, actually. He said, those are okay, but I want to biopsy these two little things on your face. And 15 minutes later, and actually it was a physician assistant, came back and said, oh, it could be cancer. You need this procedure. You need Mohs. Referred her to a university medical center where she had the thing taken off with Mohs surgery for about $2,000. And sometimes when there's a defect in Mohs, the likelihood of needing or getting, not necessarily needing, but getting a plastic surgery repair is bigger. So she was then referred to a plastic surgeon in an OR where she got, you know,
across
the street, but all within the same, on the same hospital campus, you know. And most surgeons will tell you they tend to repair on their own, but the number of repairs by plastic surgeons has gone up too.
So, and then she was given an IV and sedated.
Right. And
so that drove up the cost.
And she was very angry about that because she's working. She's a professor. She teaches. She said, I can't be out of functioning. That was the thing that bothered her most, actually, being kind of railroaded into this sedation. And as she said, you know, and I think we've all felt trapped in this patient role, what am I supposed to do? I've got a hole in my face. The doctor who's seen me won't sew it up, even though I've said, I don't care about a scar. You're trapped. And then the plastic surgeon says, I won't do this without sedation. You're in.
And is it painful? Is sedation necessary?
Well, you know, a lot of doctors, it's the same.
I mean, I've had stitches.
Yeah, it's, you know.
They didn't give me any. Maybe they gave me a local. I'm not even sure they got that.
She had local to have the initial procedure done. I think the problem is, you know, there's a lot that has to do with physician preference. There's a wide range of practice preferences and practice beliefs in American medicine. And as a patient, you're kind of captive to those. And it wasn't like someone told her 2 days before, we're going to do it this way, in which case she would have said, uh-uh. She was basically, as she said, a hostage.
But you write that she did the research about the procedure and not all patients do. Is it possible for patients to push back on procedures that cost more?
Well, I think in her case, she did the right thing and it wasn't. Sometimes you are truly a hostage in this system. In other cases, I've heard from a number of patients who've had this procedure who said, you know, I had one Mohs surgery on my back and it was took a long time and it was a nightmare. And then I read somewhere, oh, you can just use this cream twice a day for 5 weeks. And now I always do that instead. So, yes, patients can ask. But they often don't know to ask. And the real problem is there's no obligation on the part of the physician to say, look, here are the options. Many do, but some don't.
A caller said that his dermatologist has created a line of products that he expects the patients to buy and use. And the caller is concerned that he doesn't know what the ingredients are and what they should cost.
Well, I think that's a very real issue with dermatology in particular. You know, as I said, as insurance pulls back on certain kinds of payments, doctors naturally who are entrepreneurial look for other ways to make money. And one thing that's available, I mean, dermatologists have a wide array of choices. They can do more cosmetic stuff or they can start selling products. And I think, you know, to me, that's a kind of a turnoff. I'm suspicious of that. But, you know, in some cases, it may be that dermatologist may have discovered the best thing ever.
Whenever we talk about the rising cost of medical care, somebody writes in, as somebody just did, that the real problem is the high cost of malpractice insurance. And that's what is forcing doctors to charge more.
Well, you know, I've heard this again and again, and likewise to take care of it, you know, the high cost of medical education. They are both real issues. You know, no doubt about it, we have to deal with tort reform and we have to deal with finding more affordable ways to make doctors. But that being said, that doesn't explain the kind of astronomical costs we face. And I would point out that the doctors who face the really high malpractice costs are not the big earners. The OBGYNs have huge malpractice costs, but they are not at the top of the medical pay scale. The dermatologists, on the other hand, do not have the high malpractice costs, and they're up there.
There's a graph in your article that shows the pricing of 100 similar outpatient Mohs surgeries, and the range is from just under $500 to almost $7,500, more than a $7,000 differential.
Yeah.
What makes one of these procedures more expensive than the other?
The fact that we really can't comparison shop, that there's no price list of what's reasonable. And so rightly, I heard from some of the dermatologists who are charging at the 500 end of the spectrum. If you're charging at that low end, you're probably giving out most because it's needed. And they're really upset that some people are charging 7,000 because that makes everyone suspicious. Now, is it because those procedures, we tried in that graphic, it was made for us by a medical analytics company. So they tried to control, it was a healthcare blue book, for having simple Mohs procedures. So that's that kind of variation, not because one was a huge procedure and one was simple. It's just because people charge a lot of different prices in American medicine because they can.
So we should be aware that less is Mohs.
Sorry
about that. Elizabeth Rosenthal, her latest article is part of her series called Paying Till It Hurts, Is Patients' Costs Skyrocket, Specialists' Incomes Soar. It appeared in the January 18th edition of the New York Times. And we will continue our conversation. Take your calls if you want to get into this conversation. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org, and a number of people already have, and I'll get to a few of those things right after we get back. And we are back with Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times. She's been writing a series called Paying Till It Hurts about rising medical costs in this country. The most recent from January 18th was Patients' Costs Skyrocket, Specialists' Income Soar. And we have invited your call, so let's go to a caller named Elizabeth Rosenthal. Hello, you're on
Hello.
The air. Do you spell Elizabeth with a Z or an S?
I spell it with a Z.
Okay, so you're not the same person. This is not a schizophrenic moment.
No, even though it feels that way.
Go ahead. You're a doctor?
I'm a newly retired dermatologist. I'm a big fan of your show, Lenny. I've been listening for years, and also a big fan of Dr. Rosenthal's articles, and I've been reading them and I'm writing letters about them. And I think she's wonderful to expose all these, because I really think that the cost of medicine in this country is ridiculous, and dermatologists can be, you know, some of the people who abuse the system. But I'm sorry that she you know, just focused on dermatology, because there are many dermatologists like myself who do five procedures in one day that don't even cost $100 altogether, and tell patients, no, you don't need to do that because it's, you know, it's not necessary, and don't abuse the system.
But Dr. Rosenthal, I'm sure that Elizabeth said early in this show,
yes, she said
just
everybody's
that.
Not like that, yeah. Right.
She said not all doctors are doing this, but enough are that it's causing a problem.
Right. I always tell patients and family and friends, anytime a doctor wants to do something, a test, give you a medicine, do a procedure, always say, what if I don't do it? Because a lot of times the answer is not much. So I think patients should do that, and doctors should give all the options, definitely. And I think I belong to Physicians for a National Health Program, who we're fighting for a national health system, a Medicare for All system, like they have in Canada and most other industrialized countries, which would cut out a lot of these practices and also cut down on the cost of the administrative costs that we have with, you know, private for-profit health insurance.
And Dr. Rosenthal, do you think that Ted Cruz would go along with you and Paul Ryan?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you.
Not at all.
Thank you for your call. Elizabeth here in the studio, are there concerns that the widespread use of Mohs surgery could end up hurting dermatologists in the end? Because hasn't Mohs surgery been on Medicare's list of possibly misvalued procedures?
Yes, I think, and many dermatologists, like the other Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, are concerned about the overuse of some of these procedures. I mean, you know, basically what Medicare does is to say, look, it's being used way, 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 way more than it was 10 years ago, that maybe we've overvalued it. Now, they dodged that bullet this year because the American Medical Association update committee said it was valued okay. But that's a whole nother story. We rely on the American Medical Association to assess whether something is valued properly, and the American Medical Association, many doctors will tell you, is now controlled by specialists. So it perpetuates the high valuation of procedural and specialist medicine. And I'm not saying, you know, people who train for 10 years, they deserve to get paid for what they do. But the differential between specialist and procedural care and cognitive care, the kind of care you get when you go to your doctor for high blood pressure and he manages your medicines, the differential in this country is many times what it is elsewhere in the world. And that's not right.
Primary care doctors are complaining that they feel they have very little pull these days because the specialists have kind of taken over the American Medical Association's Relative Value Scale Update Committee.
Right. And I think, you know, again, I did not want, with this article, want to tar all physicians. There are many dermatologists who practice, you know, carefully and methodically. And likewise, almost every primary care doctor has no choice but to do so because they can't play this procedure game. And you know, we're saying with the Affordable Care Act, we need more primary care doctors. But the way our payment system is structured, residents, young doctors don't want to go into primary care. And that's a really big problem we should all be really worried about.
Are dermatologists likely to see growth in their market because of the Affordable Care Act?
You know, it will be a mixed bag likely for them. First of all, the Affordable Care Act guarantees yearly skin checks for everyone over 65. And if you're the kind of dermatologist who in every skin check finds three or four things to biopsy, this is going to be a moneymaker for them. You know, I have to say I have a mother who goes in, whose dermatologist wants to see her every 4 months. For what? You know, because you get paid every time you see the dermatologist.
What about procedures that are more on the cosmetic end of the spectrum, like Botox? Is that something that's a big moneymaker for dermatologists?
In some markets it is. You know, living here in Manhattan, you feel like the whole world of dermatology is Botox and fillers. But in fact, in the rest of the country, that's not the case. And, you know, at some level, that's not really a concern of mine, in the sense of if people want to pay for their cosmetic procedures, you know, that doesn't eat up our healthcare dollars. But so that market you know, it will be what it will be, as it's always been. But I'm concerned, and what the series is focusing on, is things that we all end up paying for through insurance or Medicare or Medicaid.
Medicare has lowered its reimbursements for some procedures. Mm-hmm. How did orthopedists respond when reimbursements for joint replacements went down?
Yeah, you know, this is the unfortunate game that happens now. Medicare's one screw it can really turn is to reduce the reimbursement for the procedure. So doctors will complain with some justification, oh, my God, my Medicare reimbursements are half what they were 20 years ago in real dollars for a cardiac catheterization, for a hip replacement. But what the doctors have done then is to figure out ways to make back that money by charging facility fees, by doing other stuff. And I think until we deal with properly setting doctors' fees, we're going to have this kind of ridiculous cat and mouse game that really serves no one's interest.
We've gotten a lot of calls from people who just have horror stories to tell. I'm not sure that I'm going to put them all on because they are very specific to the people. But we have a call from a lawyer. Damien, hi, you're on the air. Damien from Peekskill.
Yeah, hi, Leonard. How are you?
Great. I'm job. Well.
Thank you for taking me.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment that in the conversation about tort reform, these are ideas that we should undertake very cautiously because there are already several procedural mechanisms in place that make it more difficult for a victim of medical malpractice to be compensated for their injuries than a victim of any other sort of accident. So, I mean, just very briefly, there's already a few mechanisms in place to shelter medical malpractice defendants a little more than just the average defendant out there. And to do so further has potential dangers of people being unable to be compensated for their losses.
Damon, don't you think that this is part of a war that's going on between the lobbyists for the lawyers and the lobbyists for doctors in Washington? Whichever group has the more powerful lobbyists eventually is going to win this war.
I would just only disagree to the tiny little extent that it's not just doctors who are sort of against lawyers in that lobbying battle, but really big insurance that are against the attorneys.
Thank you for your call.
Okay.
I mentioned Botox. Haven't lobbyists for dermatologists fought more regulation and pushed to make Botox a medical procedure so spas can't offer it?
Yeah, one of the distressing things that I discovered in the course of researching this article is that the amount of lobbying dollars correlates very nicely to the best-paid specialties. So lobbying works. And I think that the things that lobbyists promote are not things that most patients would think of as in their best interest. The dermatologists have lobbied, for example, to not have to show pre-op pictures on skin lesions. Now, to me, that's something that I feel that a doctor should be making clear because you want to be accountable. Likewise, as you mentioned, they want Botox and things like that to be classified as medical procedures, which would prevent spas and non-medical providers from doing this. But, you know, that's I think they'll say, well, it's better for patients, you know, and it maybe is in some cases. But, you know, a lot of what we think of as better for patients is, in fact, about protecting income streams. And I think we have to acknowledge that. And I think if this system is going to become more cost efficient, we have to, in many areas of medicine, including primary care, get more comfortable with the idea that we can use nurses, nurse practitioners, to do things that we Americans, part of it is our demand. We want to see an MD doing. It's not always necessary.
In a previous discussion, we talked about the fact that some drugs are prescription drugs here, but over-the-counter in Europe and elsewhere,
right.
Drugs that people would not abuse, and yet they've been kept as something that has to be prescribed, I guess, that drives up prices as well.
Right.
And gastroenterologists and oncologists have also seen their compensations increase dramatically over the last 20 years. In the case of oncologists, is that because they can mark up doses of chemotherapy that they administer in their offices?
Yeah, you know, this is like so many things in American medicine. What starts as a money-saving idea turns into a money-making idea. So basically, the idea was, you know, it's cheaper to give. When I was a medical resident, chemotherapy was often given in the hospital, because it had a lot of side effects. We didn't have all these great drugs. Then it got better. You know, it got more tolerable. So you could do it in an outpatient setting. Then doctors said, well, we could give it in our offices. That would be more convenient for our patients. So far, all great. Now, the doctors, with some justification, said, but it's not just like giving a pill. So we need some support staff. So we should be able to mark up the chemo. But then it becomes, well, how much is reasonable? How much can you mark up? And there, now it's called the chemotherapy concession. And what you see is when doctors started using that chemotherapy concession and billing for chemo, some doctors, again, not all of them, made big profits doing that. And also some doctors skewed their chemotherapy to the drugs that they could make the most money on.
Does Medicare fully reimburse?
Yeah, Medicare reimburses for. I mean, they, you know, again, it's, they push back, they've lowered rates, but it's like a balloon. You know, you find they push back in one place, and you know, doctors who want to be entrepreneurial, and particularly their medical societies, who put out bulletins saying this is how you could increase your reimbursement. You know, this is what medical magazines are filled with now. Exploit it. So, you know, in many ways, the guy or woman who's just sitting in their office trying to do the right thing is really stressed. And I should mention, vis-a-vis the malpractice issue, you know, a lot of doctors out there are paying more than $100,000 a year in malpractice. Now, if you want a young doctor to go into primary care or to go into OBGYN, you're going to have to rationalize that a little bit, because it's a big disincentive.
And what can patients do to protect themselves? you haven't made it sound like we have many options.
Well, you know, rise up and demand more information for start. You can. I think one thing we all have to do, and I've said this before, is get over our inhibitions about talking about money with our doctors. You know, and many times your first conversation with the doctor is going to be, I don't know, go ask the billing office. But I think both doctors and patients have to get more comfortable with that conversation. Partly, patients have to ask, because doctors, unless they're asked, most likely don't even know what you're being
told. Well, in the past, we were told to get a second opinion. In this case, maybe we can just try to get a second price.
You could do that, although, you know, you really don't want to shop around for your bypass surgery like you would for a car. And I think the problem is, with medical care, you often don't have that much time.
Elizabeth Rosenthal's series, Paying Till It Hurts, the most recent column is Patients' Costs Skyrocket, Specialists' Incomes Soar. It appeared in the January 18th edition of the New York Times. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming by again.
Thanks for having me.